When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We're going on a 1,000-year walk through the night today on Londonist Out Loud on the back of an historical dissection of London in the dark. Before we do that, thanks so much for a lot of very interesting comments that have come in after last week's edition, the second of two on housing. A very warm email and tweets from Daniel Ruiz Tizon, who's keen to underline the seriousness and urgency of the issue of housing. Thanks also to Ravi, to DI, and to a commenter on the episode page from last week, Viewpoint of View is the name they're giving themselves. It's a long comment. The headlines are that they considered our debate to be, as they put it, somewhere between the far left and the extreme far left. The solution that they offer to the London housing crisis is to gather together those who are on social security benefits and those who are working but can't afford to live in town. Living in central London is not a human right, says the commenter. They say those people should be shipped off to live elsewhere. And they describe this as a radical and very unpopular idea. On which final point we can certainly agree. In order to repair my right-wing credentials, here comes some unalloyed capitalism for you. We've got a range of merchandise now for the show. When I say range, I mean one thing. We have a Londonist Out Loud t-shirt. It comes in a range of sizes and colours, and what could be better as you're herded onto a train with the rest of the working poor than to know you're being evicted in style in a groovy garment bearing images of the city in which you can no longer afford to live. The Londonist Out Loud t-shirt forms part of a range of bits and pieces with Londonist phrases and slogans and just generally London-y things. You can find it at moretvicar.com, but a better bet is to go to the Londonist website and find the merchandise link. Click through. We'll also try and get that link onto Acast, which if you're not using it already is a great way to listen to Londonist Out Loud because it means that pictures will pop up and you'll get to see who is talking and the places to which they refer, and it's an easy way to get bits of information like that link and other useful data pertinent to the show. I should say as well, for the record, that the show really doesn't have a political agenda, although some of the people who appear on it most certainly do. All the same, if you think you've spotted an imbalance in our content, whether political or some other sort of thing, we're always keen and grateful to hear about people to whom you think we should be making a beeline. For today, at the end of the beeline, is Matthew Beaumont, and today is the 18th of April, 2015. I'm in Quentin Wolfe, and this is Londonist Out Loud.
Hey baby, let me take you down to a place of strange sights and sounds you ain't never seen the like before. Just a stone's throw from your front door. Hey baby, sit out me, see the peace of the air, land and sea. Some creep, some saw down the road, jam brand store.
My heart aches for some far off place.
So I was contacting the PR department of a major London institution just recently. We were meeting, a guest and I, to talk about something that had occurred on their premises. And I thought it would be nice just to be authentic about it and be in the spot where it happened. So I called up the PR department, and the person I spoke to said, well, possibly it might take a little while to arrange it. A lot of paperwork's involving in filming. And I said, no filming involved. This is just audio. And she said, well, if it's just audio, why on earth do you need to be there? So with that thought in mind, we're talking about nighttime today, and it's streaming sunshine, and I've been trying to work out whether we should pretend that it is in fact pitch black. We're sitting in a very lovely garden outside the Camden Arts Centre. With me is Matthew Beaumont, and he's the author of Night Walking, a Nocturnal History of London. Hello.
Hi, good to see you.
Are we breaking the rules of authenticity here?
I don't think so. I too was havering and wondering whether, you know, given that the noises from the Finchley Road sound as if they could have come from the night, whether it would have been a good idea to pretend that we were plunged in Stygian darkness. But you know, frankly, the sunshine's too rare and enjoyable. So let's celebrate it.
Let's start with the inception of the project. I know that how many books there are about London, and going to any bookshop that has an area that even makes a gesture towards local history, for example, and there are authors coming at London from all sorts of different angles. To what extent were you on the search for a new angle, and to what extent did the night appeal to you naturally?
You're right that it is quite a crowded market, London, and social history, literary history, you know, encyclopedias, pop accounts, graphic novels, short stories. So the bookshops do get very crowded in the big, particularly the independent bookshops in London. I think I wasn't looking for a corner of that market which hadn't been colonised, although I do think that, you know, the night hasn't been covered sufficiently. It's been overlooked, undoubtedly, in accounts of the history of London. But no, the origins of the book really came from two things. First of all, I like to walk in London at night. I like to encounter another kind of city. I think the city at night is a very different one to the city in the day, even in the so-called 24-hour city that we supposedly inhabit, even with, you know, good electric lighting in lots of places, not that it is good everywhere. So there was that I like to go out into the night, and you know, sometimes it was relatively often, others not. I like to walk the entire way through the night. But I also, in my other life as a lecturer in English at UCL, University College London, I teach really the whole sweep of English literary history, and I began to realise that a lot of the authors that I was teaching, a lot of the authors to whom I'm most attached, were individuals who used to go into London at night. Particularly, I'm thinking of romantics and post-romantics, people like Blake, De Quincey, Dickens. All of them had a kind of compulsive need to inhabit the streets of the city at night.
And we're going to be meeting some of those literary figures as we go through the story of London at night. I've cast my eyes over your book, and it is a literary work, there's no question about that. It's very rich, and I think this is the sort of thing, as opposed to something that one would dip in and out of easily, this is something to really be engrossed by, much as one would allow oneself to be enveloped by the night, so one plunges into your work, I suspect. And the time frame for the work is probably worth talking about as well, because it's not up to the present day.
No, I'd originally intended to write a book on London at night from the mid-19th century, from Dickens, really, who I'm particularly passionate about, to the present, because there's all sorts of interesting material there, you know, right up to contemporary filmmakers and novelists like Chris Pettit and Ian Sinclair and Will Self. But I then, when I started looking at the topic more closely, realised that I had to tunnel back deep down into the past and excavate, as I saw it at the time, the prehistory of the 19th and 20th century, the modern night walker. And the more I did dig down, the more I excavated this past, the more interesting the story seemed to me, and the more, in fact, it seemed to me to be the most important story to tell. The reason for that is because, and the breakthrough when I was beginning the book for me was the discovery that in the medieval period, the night walker was in fact a legal entity. It wasn't just a kind of label one might apply more or less glamorously, more or less slummily to, I don't know, the sort of bohemian poets that from the 18th, 19th century onwards hang about in the streets of the city at night. It was an actual legal entity. So in the late 13th century, Edward I introduced a statute, the purpose of which was to police the curfew. And a curfew which had been introduced in the late 11th century by William I. And it was called, this statute, the Nightwalker Statute. And the particular urban subject that it partly constructed, I suppose, and partly targeted was the so-called common night walker. In other words, there were at least two kinds of night walker in the Middle Ages, and this bifurcation persists, you know, for centuries. I think there was the rich night walker, there was the night walker from the elite classes, who could move around the city at night even after the curfew with relative impunity. They were often accompanied by a retinue of servants who would carry forms of lighting. Sometimes they travelled not on foot but by horse or in carriages. And then, in very stark contrast, there was the common night walker, this figure who gets targeted and constructed in the night walker statute. And the common night walker was a plebeian subject. It wasn't specifically a female subject. I mean, it's often assumed that night walkers and street walkers are the same thing. That conflation of night walker and street walker doesn't happen till much later, probably the 17th and 18th century. In the Middle Ages and the early modern period, a night walker could be either male or female, and it referred, on the one hand, to a vagrant, an itinerant, a migrant worker, out of work on the whole, unemployed and homeless often, or it, on the other hand, referred to what today we'd call a sex worker, a prostitute. So those were the two kinds of common night walker, and there was a systematic attempt in the Middle Ages and the early modern period, at a time when, so I argue in the book, labour and a kind of ideology of labour and of hard work was becoming more and more enshrined in the capitalist and Protestant ethic. There was more and more emphasis on the importance of sleep in order to restore the body of the labourer for the day's work, and consequently more and more there was an attempt to marginalise, anathematise, criminalise people who didn't go to sleep at night and function effectively and efficiently as labourers in the day, but who upset the rhythms of the working day by being homeless, by not being in work, by hanging about on the streets at night, and who also disrupted the ideology of the family, which was also emerging at this time.
Oh, the more things change. So there's a couple of building blocks here which I want to make sure have been fashioned completely. The curfew was from when to when?
The curfew, the beginning of the curfew is relatively easy to define. It's introduced in the late 11th century, I think 1086. I may have misremembered that very slightly. So within, you know, 20 or so years of the Norman conquest, introduced by William I, ostensibly to prevent fire in the city, to prevent conflagration. So the word curfew is a corruption of the French couvre-feu, in other words, cover fire, and it was about covering fire, both the fire of lamps and hearth fires, more importantly.
Oh, well, hold on, so it wasn't just everybody has to be home, but it has to be lights out too?
Exactly, yeah, it was lights out because of the risk of fire, but it was also a way, more surreptitiously, but probably more pressingly, of policing the politics of the night. In other words, preventing, preempting political conspiracies, which often sort of festered at night and were often kind of, you know, fostered at night. So the curfew was introduced in the late 11th century. It persists for a couple of centuries, but it's really hard to tell exactly when it dies away, because there's not a formal moment at which it suddenly becomes redundant, suddenly stops. It's probably imposed more and more laxly. It gets harder and harder to police because the city outgrows its boundaries. You know, the suburbs and the slums spring up on the other sides of the city walls. And then anyway, finally, in the 17th, particularly the 18th century, a kind of nightlife emerges, which simply isn't compatible with the idea of the curfew. So, you know, in the late 17th century, public lighting is first introduced in London in the 1680s, and by that time really the death knell has been sounded for the curfew very comprehensively. It's completely died out by then. But what I argue in the book is that, in spite of that, although formally, legally, in policing terms, there's no longer a curfew by then, it's long gone, there is a kind of moral curfew. And indeed one might say that a moral curfew still exists at night, that people who are out on the streets at night, particularly if they're on their own, infringe a kind of unwritten moral code.
And the precise time on the clock face at which everybody has to be tucked up is when?
Well, good question. It differed depending on whether it was winter or summer. It was usually 8 o'clock in the winter in the Middle Ages and 9 o'clock in the summer. Probably got shunted back to 9 o'clock in the winter, 10 o'clock in the summer, after you know, 100 or so years. Slightly hard to tell. And at that point, the gates of the walled city would close, the bells of all the churches would ring out, the curfew would be rung, the wicket gates on the side of the city gates would be closed shortly after the city gates were closed. Any stragglers would kind of quickly hurry in or hurry out, and then the wicket gates too would be closed, and then the night watchmen would begin their rounds. They were very interesting figures, the night watchmen.
Well, that's exactly the figure I realised must be existing, because you mentioned the word policed a couple of times, and that suggests that there was a third group of people out and about.
Absolutely right. There was a third group of people, and they did police the city, although often incompetently and corruptly and inefficiently, and they were the night watchmen. And, you know, the night watchman was the only police force effectively right in Britain, right up to the introduction of the peelers in the early 19th century in England. So the night watchmen, who are introduced in the Middle Ages to police the curfew and to patrol the streets of the city at night, are, you know, they last for centuries and centuries and centuries, and they really are a pretty hopeless, if not corrupt, bunch. And why they're interesting is because as a third entity in the night, as you've rightly indicated, is because they occupy this very ambiguous place between rich and poor. I mean, their role is, they've got several roles, one of which is clearly to protect property, the property of the rich, but they are often themselves, even though they are policing prostitutes, vagrants, the night walkers of the city, they are often themselves from, almost invariably in fact, from the very poorest backgrounds. They often, not unlike security men today, in fact, who you see in office buildings in London and other cities at night, they were often doing more than one job. They were, you know, very much from a plebeian and poor background themselves. They were extremely poorly equipped, often badly dressed. I mean, they, you know, didn't have a lot of protection from the cold. They used to swathe their heads in rags in order to protect themselves from the cold. They were very poorly armed. They might have had a halberd, say, if they were really lucky, but, you know, probably they just had a stick and maybe a bell and a lamp of some kind, an oil lamp of some kind. But they were very ambiguous morally. They were legally quite ambiguous too. They used to fence goods, stolen goods. They often made arrangements with criminals. They often allowed the rich, for a small fee, to have exclusive and absolute rights to any streets they liked. They often exploited prostitutes. They sometimes pimped. They were a complicating factor in the city at night and a very volatile and unreliable community of people.
Besides the practical ones of getting locked out of the city, for example, what sort of punishments would one face for breaking curfew?
That's a very good question. I mean, there were specific jails in the Middle Ages and the early modern period for nightwalkers. So the probably the most prominent of these in the sort of 13th, 14th centuries, I think, was called the Tun, so named because it looked like a barrel of beer. And they were incarcerated there. They were sometimes ritually humiliated, so they might have their heads shaved and they might be paraded through the streets. So yes, there was, I mean, incarceration was the main form of, you know, criminalizing the nightwalks, but sometimes too they were, as it were, scapegoated. They were almost ritualistically humiliated in order to demonstrate what, you know, what the consequences were if you hung about in the streets at night.
So from what you said, I'm understanding that the beginnings of this came about from an occupying force wanting to keep a lid on dissent to a greater degree. And as things move forward, it starts to be turned into an insertion of moral backbone into a force of workers. How did that evolve as we move through time and technology and lifestyle transforms?
I mean, you've summarised it extremely well. That is the first important shift, I suppose. The next big shift is the introduction of public street lighting in the late 17th century. The legal curfew falls into desuetude, but a moral curfew persists, and the night watchman still police the streets at night. The history of the night both does and doesn't change over the course of centuries, right up to the time of gaslight in the 19th century. There's a sense in which there's a kind of trans-historical story to be told. You know, the experience of homelessness, for example, whether you were a vagrant in the Middle Ages or a so-called houseless person in the 19th century, it didn't change very much at all. One might argue that it still hasn't changed much. Yes, some of the sort of superstructural attempts to deal with the problem of homelessness and the community of vagrants or prostitutes out on the streets at night changes. You know, in the 19th century, charitable institutions, for example, spring up in an attempt to deal with the problem. But, you know, the basic experience of being on the streets at night really doesn't change much at all. However, there's a story also to be told, and which I try to tell in the book, which is more discontinuous, and that is the rise, really, of the bohemian. Often, you know, poets in the 18th century, Grub Street poets specifically, who inhabits the night almost deliberately in order to examine and explore the underside of the city, and in order to kind of challenge the promise of the Enlightenment and the claims that the Enlightenment culture makes about itself to be so civilized, in order to challenge that and reveal that beneath its utopian claims that actually, you know, there's really quite a dystopian city.
Are there present day analogues or relatively present day analogues there? I was thinking of sort of gross out.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Or heroin chic or some of those things that we've seen in the last 20, 30 years maybe. Do we find anything that we can relate that to in the present day?
Well, I suppose slumming has got a long history, hasn't it? You know, it's really in the 18th century, I think, when nightlife as such begins to emerge and shops stay open late and their windows get illuminated and the commodities inside them get lit in really quite artful ways.
Oh, can I jump on that? Yeah. Because I seem to remember, and you are in the perfect position to tell me what I'm getting wrong, but I remember, I think, that there was a big change in theatrical lighting and the technical ability to light the inside of a theatre that I think occurred after the Restoration, somewhere around there. Am I vaguely close, and has that got anything to do with anything?
Yes, you're absolutely right. It does. I mean, and you're right to to point to that at this juncture, I think, because really, because that's part of the prehistory of the public illumination of the streets. So in the 17th century, in the early 17th century, theatrical lighting, often in the form of thousands of candles, becomes one of the most spectacular characteristics of the court mask. So public illumination at night from the early 16th, 17th century is an aristocratic, if not monarchical, phenomenon. But towards the end of that century, towards the end of the 17th century, with the Restoration, the introduction of new technologies, there's a kind of embourgeoisement of public lighting. It's no longer just about an aristocratic, about lighting the night for the sake of aristocratic pastimes, leisure, pleasure. It's about remoulding the city in the evenings and at night so that the middle classes too have access to it, so that they have access to shops, so that it's safer, and you know, not just public street lighting, it's safer pavements and that kind of thing. So yes, in a sense, the theatre, specifically the court mask, pioneers what will become public street lighting. It's about political power. It's about staging political power.
We are powered by our sponsor, who is Audible. And if you'd like to try out their service, you can do so for free for 30 days. Just go to audible.com. And also, you get a free audio book. Any title you fancy is yours for free. If you go to audible.com/Londonist, Matthew Beaumont, what would you recommend from Audible?
What I'd recommend is something called London, A Short History of the Greatest City of the World, which is part of a great courses series. And this is given by Robert Buchholz, who's the co-author of a really wonderful book that came out a couple of years ago called London, A Social History, I think, some sort of 1550 to 1750. So an early modern history of early modern London, and it's absolutely full of detail. It's a really rich and readable book.
You're listening to Londonist Out Loud. I'm in Quentin Wolfe, and with me is Matthew Beaumont, the author of Night Walking, a nocturnal history of London. And we've just switched on the lights, chronologically speaking. And, well, we're about to get literary. You're from a literary background. We encountered earlier on among the groups of people who were roving around the streets at night, I guess they'd be called revellers now. And what I've got a bit of an image of the kind of people who turn up in the stretch limo outside a nightclub and get the VIP entrance past the bouncers. And I'm imagining that they're the sort of people who'd be on horseback with their own lights and so forth. Well, these were the privileged few. Is that the case with the literary figures we're going to see?
No, not so much the literary figures. You're absolutely right about the stretch limo driving figures in the early modern period, the roisterers and revellers, as they were called, with their retinues and their flaming torches and their loose morals.
And they're still called revellers, and yet I've never met anybody who admits to revelling. Or, what are you doing? I'm revelling.
Maybe the odd Hooray Henry admits to revelling. I don't know. I don't like to think of them. I'd like to think they were a dying species at the very least. Yes, the poets, the bohemians, and the proto-bohemians from the 18th century onwards identified very firmly, very committedly with the vagrants who inhabited the city at night and not with the rich. In fact, the very fact that they went on foot, some of these figures, the Grub Street authors and the urban romanticists of the late 18th century and the early 19th century, was itself proof of their sort of anti-aristocratic credentials. So there's a lot of stuff in the poetry and the prose of the early and mid 18th century about how important it is to travel on foot. Pedestrianism is a political gesture, in an urban context, as it later became for the Romantics in a rural context, more obviously. So they rejected those who travel about by carriage and who look at the world through a window and who are surrounded by servants. What the Grub Street poets relish doing, I'm thinking of Samuel Johnson, of Richard Savage, of Oliver Goldsmith and various others, what they like to do is, as it were, get down and dirty on the streets at night They sympathised with the prostitutes, they sympathised with the vagrants and the homeless, and they saw them as, in a sense, telling a deeper and a hidden truth about the city that was concealed and repressed beneath the great show of enlightenment and civilization and consumerism.
This reminds me a great deal of some of those books from the 60s, like Up the Junction or Saturday Night, Sunday Morning, those kind of, as though we'd just discovered the working class.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, so the Grub Street poets of the 18th century did, not unlike those 60s writers, speak in a sense in the authentic voice of the working class or the plebeian population of London. That was because they led extremely precarious lives as writers. So the figures like Samuel Johnson, Richard Savage, Oliver Goldsmith, who I've mentioned, were close to homeless at times. They were really grubbing along in the most mean and servile way, trying to get piecemeal literary work from magazines, periodicals, trying to sell their poems practically by the inch and foot, and they were, you know, virtually homeless. So even Samuel Johnson, who we think of course, as this kind of monumental figure of English literature and this monumental man of letters, you know, immortalised by Boswell, etc., was in his youth a decrepit, marginal figure who hung out with this very strange character, Richard Savage, who was his mentor for several very significant, influential years, and who was frequently homeless himself at times when he had no money, who was led this very sort of disreputable existence, pretending, it seems, probably pretending to be the sort of outcast son of an aristocratic family, getting into all sorts of scrapes. And by scrapes, I mean, you know, he was in prison for murder and generally drinking too much, sleeping on the streets, in you know, next to glass houses, glass factories where there was warmth to be derived from the bricks. And so, you know, that was the milieu that these, you know, even writers who later became very respectable, like Johnson, inhabited at this time. So they really, you know, they were not just substituting for the voices of the plebeians. They were speaking from experience, too, to an extent.
And bringing it back to the Night in particular, what sort of things were they revealing to you as you researched your book?
Well, there's a wonderful piece by essay, really, by Oliver Goldsmith from the sort of early to mid 18th century, called a City Night piece, and he goes out into the city at about 2 o'clock in the morning, and he describes this really dystopian, almost lunar cityscape, this really, you know, sort of rotten, desert-like landscape, which is populated by prostitutes and by homeless men and women. And he points very emphatically to the fact that the condition of the homeless people is caused by the rich. And he talks about how they refuse to take any responsibility for them, how feeble and inadequate philanthropic, charitable attempts to solve these sorts of social problems are. But even more compelling than the politics of that piece, really, is the imaginative flight that it describes. He pictures it as in some ways proleptic of the future, as in some way anticipating the future. It's as if one gets a glimpse of what the collapse of civilization centuries hence might look like if one goes out into the streets at night and sees all its, usually in the day, busy spaces full of colourful people suddenly emptied, and instead of those bustling crowds we see stragglers, you know, vagrants, exiles really from the city in the day.
It's got overtones of zombie film right there, I think. All this apocalyptic thinking leads us, I suspect, rather neatly to Blake.
Yeah, Blake had a really interesting relationship with the night and with London at night, I think. It can be slightly hard to reconstruct that relationship because, well, partly because Blake is Blake and because his poetry is, you know, often impenetrable, frankly. And even when it's not impenetrable, as in the Songs of Innocence and Experience, is kind of mystifying. So we have to work quite hard, or at least I felt I had to work quite hard in order to establish what the night is doing in his prophetic poems in particular. But I think the night is doing an awful lot. He uses the night really as a way of exploring the underside of the Enlightenment. So his relentless attack on a rationalistic Enlightenment culture suggests that that rationalistic Enlightenment culture actually casts a deep black shadow over the city and over humanity. So the paradoxical effect of Enlightenment and illumination for him is even greater darkness. And he goes out into the streets, I think, at night, and one sees this, I suspect, this is my argument at one point in the book, in his poem London from the Songs of Experience, he goes out into the streets at night in order almost homeopathically to present the night as this dreadful dystopian space in order to kind of shove it back in the face of the Enlightenment. You know, this is really what your Enlightenment generates, what its consequences are, he's saying. It's prostitutes on the streets, it's the blood of soldiers running down church walls, it's the harlot's cry, it's chartered streets, as he calls them. In other words, it's a city that's been kind of carved up by property and is defined by its commercial imperatives. And the night for him becomes an opportunity for a way of unchartering the streets, of sort of undoing something of the logic of the Enlightenment, I think. I mean, he did have there's certainly one scene which happened after dark, which is of really quite crucial, if not epiphanic, importance in his biography, and that's the night in 1780. It was the fifth night of the Gordon riots, the anti-Catholic riots of the time, when supposedly, I mean, it's possible it's apocryphal, but it, you know, and there are different legendary accounts of this, but it seems likely that it happened in some way or form. He was suddenly caught up walking along up St. Martin's Lane towards Great Queen Street, I think. He was strolling, as he often did, in order to go and see his old master, the engraver to whom he'd been apprenticed, James Bazier, and he was suddenly swept up in this crowd of people who were charging up towards Newgate Prison. He tumbled along in this crowd and ends up in front of Newgate, witnessing the firebombing in effect of the prison and the liberation of the prisoners, particularly those who'd been jailed over the previous four nights for their role in the anti-Catholic riots. Although by this time the riots weren't just anti-Catholic; they'd expanded, and in some ways they were sort of anti-capitalist riots. I don't want to overdo it. But they were sort of anti-capitalist riots by this stage. They, you know, the fifth night involved the sacking of the Bank of England as well as the sacking of and the firing of Newgate. So it had become more politically generalised and rather more militant and you know, in some way slightly less offensive by then. But and so Blake witnesses on that evening this spectacular scene, which is the vast conflagration of this symbol of oppression and justice. In other words, injustice, which is the in Newgate as an emblem of the prison system. And that has a clearly, really, you know, deeply impresses itself on his consciousness and on the prophetic poems, which are full of images of prisons being consumed in apocalyptic fire. So he found something very liberating about that. And it was particularly spectacular against the night, the London night. But he was also, I suspect, rather traumatized by it, too.
That's very interesting echoes there of something Caroline Shenton, my guest a few weeks ago, something she said about Dickens taking inspiration, in her view, from the burning of the Houses of Parliament. It seems to have impressed itself upon his imagination in a similarly profound way. We're knocking on the door of the end of the show, and I know that we've still got a decent dose of gaslighting to squeeze in, but we're going to be finding ourselves ending up in the 19th century. What sort of note do we end on in terms of London's relationship with the darkest hours?
Well, I mean, the book finishes with Dickens, who's really the ultimate nightwalker, because he's such a neurotic and a compulsive nightwalker, because he loves the gaslit streets, he loves the mystery of the streets at night, the strange blur of the gaslights, the magic, the poetry, if you like, of the gaslight, and the whispering of the gas in the pipes. But he's driven into these streets at night not just because he finds a kind of poetry in them as the great lover of London, but also because he's being chased by demons. So the periods of his life in which he spends most time on the streets at night are the ones where he's most acutely stressed. And, you know, frankly, today he'd be on heavy medication, frankly, in order to prevent his going out onto the streets, in order to cure his chronic insomnia. He would, you know, set out into the streets at night in order to escape his oppressive domestic condition. At the time, his relationship with his wife was collapsing. He would set out in the streets to escape his anxieties about financial issues, his relationship with his father. It's a whole psychological complex for him, the city at night. And not only that, he's an absolutely inveterate night walker. He covers enormous distances at night. I mean, more than anyone else I encountered in researching this book. You know, sometimes as much as 30 miles he'd cover in a single night. I mean, he walked at a phenomenal speed, but, well, certainly at that distance. I mean, he'd walk consistently at 4 miles an hour, which over 30 miles and overnight is shattering. It's a frankly shattering speed. I've tried to emulate him, and it's pretty difficult to do.
But he wasn't sleeping.
No, but he does describe in some extraordinary passages, both in the letters and in the odd essay, he describes effectively falling asleep on the road at night. So there's an occasion which he was particularly proud of. He boasted about it in his correspondence afterwards, when he set out from Tavistock Square in Bloomsbury in the middle of the night and walked all the way to Gadshill Place down in Kent, along the old London Road to Dover overnight. That is a distance of 30 miles. And he describes falling asleep, or at least lapsing into a sort of hallucinatory state on the road, hallucinating, for example, horsemen passing by, hallucinating signposts which don't lead anywhere, imagining that he's in the foothills of the Alps rather than on a road in southeast England. And, you know, that's what's so fascinating about his experiences as a night walker and his extraordinarily rich poetic accounts of it, is that they're so phantasmagoric, they're so dreamlike. He really encounters a completely different self. He doesn't just encounter a different kind of city in his night walks. He explores a different kind of self, and he gets pretty close to what, you know, 50 years later would be called the unconscious, I suppose, to exploring the unconscious as a space, as a territory in those writings.
Well, that idea of a different self, a different identity, different perception of self seems like a good note to end on when we think about London's relationship with itself and how the night might change that. The book Night Walking, A Nocturnal History of London, is published by Verso. It's £20, and by Jove, it's in shops this minute now. Matthew Beaumont, thanks very much.
Thank you, Quentin, very much.
And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to Matthew Beaumont. Thanks to Mark Barr and Bernie Barkley. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe.
sounds you ain't never seen the light before. Just a stone's throw from your front door.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.